Prostate Net presents Advanced Stage Prostate Cancer. This is Dave Evans of HearThis.com speaking today with Dr. Tia Higano. Dr. Higano received her MD from the University of Massachusetts at Worcester, Massachusetts. She completed her internal medicine residency at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine, Rochester, Minnesota. She was a postdoctoral fellow in hematology and oncology at the University of Washington at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Higano, typically we've seen advanced stage prostate cancer as a failure of secondary therapy, which traditionally occurred when the patient becomes hormone refractory. In other words, the body no longer responds to hormone control of tumor growth. Would you discuss this with us and offer your perspective on this stage of the disease?
The first thing I think that people need to understand is when we say hormone refractory, we're really using that term in quotes, because oftentimes patients who have rising PSA on hormonal therapy do respond to other types of hormonal therapy. So that's the first point I'd like to make about that. The second point is there's really two major situations in which this occurs. One is in the situation where the patient has not had any demonstrable spread of prostate cancer on bone scan or CAT scan, but they've had a rising PSA and been treated usually for a matter of years with hormonal therapy. But then the PSA starts rising with a low testosterone level and the scans don't show any metastases. So that is a situation that occurs in many patients these days. So they don't have metastatic disease seen on scans, but they do have a rising PSA, and they are considered hormone refractory. The other large population of patients that we have is patients who do have demonstrable metastatic disease on bone scan and or CAT scan. This is the more common group that we see, in fact, and treat, and probably this is really the focus of most of the rest of the discussion. And within that category of patients, there are those who have usually bone metastases but have no symptoms related to that situation. And then there's the population of patients who do have symptoms, and usually the symptoms are bone pain, fatigue, loss of appetite. So two major subpopulations within this group of patients who have bone metastases.
What is the difference between hormonal therapy, both continuous and intermittent, and combined androgen blockade? Do these cure the disease?
Hormonal therapy is a very broad term, and I think even physicians don't necessarily use this term very well, because there's several approaches. Hormonal therapy traditionally has referred to treatments that lower the male hormone testosterone level, because we know that testosterone can stimulate prostate cancer tumor growth. So usually that includes either removal of the testicles that make testosterone or turning off of the testicles by usually an injection that causes production of testosterone to cease. But there's also hormonal therapy approaches that do not lower the testosterone level, yet do alter the hormone environment, and it can also result in lowering PSA. Now, with respect to continuous or intermittent therapy, first of all, the traditional hormone testosterone lowering approach, and that's when I'm saying hormonal therapy any time from now on, I'm going to be talking about hormonal therapy that lowers the testosterone level. So continuous hormonal therapy is what has been the standard of care for patients with metastatic prostate cancer in the bone since the 1940s. And that traditionally was removal of the testicles, because that's all we had, until the early 1980s, when we had the injectable drugs that lower testosterone production as an alternative to removal of the testicles. Based on some animal data and subsequently human data, we have looked at giving hormonal therapy on an intermittent basis. And why? Because hormonal therapy has a lot of side effects, and if we can give hormonal therapy intermittently, we can decrease the side effects overall by allowing the testosterone levels to come back up during the time the patient is not treated with hormonal therapy. So this is still considered investigational because it's not been shown to be as good as continuous hormonal therapy. Nonetheless, many patients choose this intermittent approach for quality of life reasons. Understand that there are two trials that have now gathered over 1,000 patients in each trial to try to answer this question about which one is better or are they the same, continuous versus intermittent, but we don't know the answer to that yet. Combined androgen blockade is combining the medical method of lowering testosterone with a pill. What the pill adds to the injection is that the pill blocks another source of testosterone that comes from the adrenal gland. We know that most of the testosterone comes from the testicles, but a small percentage comes also from the adrenal gland, so the pill actually blocks whatever small amount may be left circulating even after you turn the testicles off from producing testosterone. So, does hormonal therapy cure the disease? The commonly accepted answer to that question is no, but I have some patients, and I think all physicians who treat a lot of prostate cancer have some patients in their practices who appear to have been cured from the disease with hormonal therapies. That's my perspective on that.
So is there a trigger point with PSA levels that indicate the necessity of moving from hormonal therapy to a more intensive medication therapy?
Short answer, no. And the reason is this. The PSA level means something different in every patient. You can have a patient who has a PSA that's very low in the single digits, who might have many, many bone metastases, and you can have what you would expect, really, which is a person who has a PSA in the 1,000 range who also has many, many bone metastases. So there's two things. Patient to patient, the PSA means something different. It really depends on how the tumor behaves in terms of releasing PSA out into the circulation. The second thing to remember is that over time, the PSA in the same patient, the actual level of the PSA, may mean something different at an early point in the disease than it does at a later point in the disease. It would be great if we said, oh, yes, a PSA of, let's say, 25 means you need to do something. Unfortunately, it's not that simple at all, and that's why it's important for patients to see physicians who understand this concept.
And is it also then important? I mean, this, I think, is one of the drivers we've talked about in earlier podcasts, particularly for men who are prone to the disease or men over 50, you know, et cetera, to establish for themselves with their physician a PSA baseline. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that, again, there's not a simple answer to this. In a patient who has had a radical prostatectomy, that patient should understand that his PSA should be undetectable. And it should be undetectable not just once, but it should be checked periodically. And even though a lot of urologists tell patients that they're cured at 5 years, we've seen many patients relapse after 5 years. And so that needs to continue to be monitored. In patients who are treated with primary radiation therapy, in other words, they had either external beam radiation or seed implants or proton radiation therapy, it's a little bit more complex, but yes, there is commonly a low-level PSA that's acceptable but does still need monitoring. When you're talking about advanced disease with possible metastases in bone or whatever. Yeah, I mean, what we're doing is comparing one PSA at a certain time to the next PSA, and, you know, are our therapies working? Now, we have to be very careful not to overreact only to the PSA when we're having to treat patients with different types of therapies for metastatic disease, because we know that PSA is not the only story. In other words, we may start a treatment for a person with metastatic disease, and the PSA starts at one level. And the next time we give the treatment again, it may be a little bit up. But that doesn't mean the treatment isn't working yet. As a matter of fact, we know from studies that have looked at this question that sometimes it takes 3 cycles of chemotherapy, for example, before we can determine if the treatment is really working. So we usually need a 12-week window of treatment before we can give up, even though we may have had some PSAs in between that are rising. So we have to be careful at that stage of the disease not to overreact. And then there are some forms of treatment, specifically some of the immunotherapy approaches, where we see the PSA continue to go up and up and up even after 12 weeks. And we may not see a decline in PSA at all, or we may see a decline at a much later time because it takes a while for immunotherapy to kind of kick in. The other thing is that some drugs may actually increase the amount of PSA that's put out by the tumor into the circulation. So even if the cancer is put in check, it may be deceptive. If the PSA is rising, you know, you may make an erroneous assumption. So you have to have a discussion with your doctor about what to expect with PSA and how PSA is going to be used to monitor the disease for that particular situation that you're in.
When should a patient move from their primary physician, either urologist or radiation oncologist, to seek the counsel and services of a medical or genitourinary oncologist?
I think that's a very regional question depending on where you live in the country. I mean, certainly the easy answer is anybody who has metastatic disease in general should at least see a medical oncologist for an opinion. Now, many urologists do treat patients with metastatic prostate cancer, but usually most urologists are not comfortable or actually, their offices are not set up in most cases to administer chemotherapy and some of the other treatments that medical oncologists give on a daily basis. But there are certain places in the country where urologists actually are working with medical oncologists out of their own offices. I mean, that's the exception rather than the rule, but I don't want to make any generalities without describing that situation. But I think really that once a person with prostate cancer who's had treatment for it in the past, maybe surgery or radiation, and now finds themselves in a situation where the disease has recurred, what you want to ask yourself is, well, I can go with the advice of my urologist or radiation oncologist, and many times they'll have an idea about what should be done. Or should I get a second opinion, at least, from a genitourinary oncologist specialist? And that would be where I would say that's one place in the course of the disease to at least find out what's going on out there. Because what you'd like to know is, are there any novel or interesting therapeutic options that your urologist or radiation oncologist can't offer you? On the other hand, maybe that person that you're already seeing has some interesting clinical trials that you might be interested in participating in, but you want to understand as a patient what the breadth of your options are. When you don't have metastatic disease, sometimes that means you do have to go to usually a tertiary care center, you know, a university or major cancer center in your area to find out what clinical trials are available.
Common belief is that chemotherapy is the next stage of treatment for hormone refractory disease. Is this true, and are there other therapeutic options?
Well, I alluded to that earlier. I mean, in fact, you know, as I said, hormone refractory is in quotes. So depending on what other hormone treatments a person has had before, many patients often respond to other so-called second-line hormonal manipulations. Those would include either adding or subtracting an anti-androgen. Those are the drugs that I mentioned earlier that block testosterone production from the adrenal gland. So if you weren't on one of those, you can add one. If you were on one, you can stop it because sometimes that results in a response. Some patients do well with estrogen compounds or diethylstilbestrol. Ketoconazole is commonly used. That's a fungal drug that has reasonable efficacy in prostate cancer. And there are other hormonal manipulations. I think that for this stage of disease, particularly in patients who have metastatic hormone refractory prostate cancer, especially those without symptoms, there are many other non-standard therapies that are available on clinical trials that are not chemotherapy. This wasn't true 10 years ago. Now there are many interesting drugs out there for patients to help us find better treatments for this stage of disease. And the only way we can do that is by getting these clinical trials done and figuring out what looks good and what's looking better than what we've had before.
You know that hormonal therapy has a clock, a certain amount of time before it no longer works. Is the same true with chemotherapy?
You know, in general, yes. But if you ask me what kind of time we have on this clock, I would have to say it's extremely variable. We know that once cancer has spread to the bones, no treatment in general is curative. You know, we go in with that principle. On the other hand, we have many things we can do to keep the disease in check and treat symptoms and improve quality of life. So the chemotherapy clock, yes, there's a chemotherapy clock, but you know how long it ticks for is variable. I have a patient I'm treating now who's been on and off chemo for metastatic disease in the bones for almost 10 years. So that just gives you the range of a short time to a very long time. And his clock hasn't given out yet, by the way.
We should all be so fortunate. Huh?
I know.
Is there anything that can be done with medications, diet, lifestyle, and similar that can prevent cancer from progressing without using chemo or other advanced therapy?
If the disease has spread, and we know that by a bone scan, for example, I would not advocate only lifestyle changes. In my practice, I try to help patients understand what they can do for themselves, and those are lifestyle changes, and then what I can do in combination with those. So the specific lifestyle changes that we address do include diet and trying to achieve ideal body weight with a healthy diet. There's nothing specific, by the way, in my opinion, about a prostate cancer diet that isn't related to a diet that's healthy for your cardiovascular system. We also recommend exercise because exercise, first of all, can help you achieve your ideal body weight, but it is an actual treatment for many of the side effects of hormonal therapy, including, you know, hot flashes, loss of muscle mass, fatigue, depression. It has beneficial effects on your cholesterol levels. It helps prevent falling in older people by gaining strength. I mean, you know, you can go on and on. There's many, many benefits of exercise, not to mention that it's good for your heart and lungs. And then finally, if I have patients who have bad habits, meaning smoking or excessive alcohol intake, these are things that we address. And these three areas, diet, exercise, and bad habits, these are things that patients can do for themselves. And I think it's important for the patient to participate in the whole process of getting and staying well.
There are often many extreme side effects associated with those therapeutics managing advanced stage disease. How do you help your patients deal with pain, fatigue? You know, you've mentioned a couple of these: mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, hair loss, infections, the kinds of things that can happen.
Right. So I think the list that you just went down, basically, pain and fatigue are usually side effects of advanced prostate cancer, whereas the rest of the side effects, nausea, vomiting, mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, hair loss, infections, those are usually side effects of some of the treatments that we give to our patients. So I think the best way to think about this is patients tend to have side effects just from having cancer when it is metastatic. And pain, as I said earlier, usually bone pain, fatigue, loss of appetite, those are symptoms of disease that are usually telling us this is a good time to consider chemotherapy. But then patients say, oh, no, but I'm going to have all these other side effects. You know, the last ones on the list that you mentioned. However, in this day and age, we're very good at preventing many of the side effects. The most gratifying thing is when we have a patient come back and say, after the first cycle of chemo, you know what, I actually feel better, and I didn't have any of the nausea and vomiting, blah, 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 because you gave me different medicines for that. You know, when we do have these side effects, we might lower the chemotherapy dose, we might increase medications to prevent nausea and vomiting, we might give medicines to increase the white blood count to help prevent infections. Obviously, anything having to do with how your bowels work, that's usually not a huge problem. Hair loss, I mean, that is one thing on this list that we haven't been too successful in preventing. Not all drugs cause hair loss, however. And sometimes the way we give a drug might minimize hair loss. At the end of the day, what you have to ask yourself is, net, do I feel better than I did before I had this treatment, whatever this treatment is? And if the answer is no, then you and your doctor need to ask yourself, well, what are we trying to accomplish here? If you're not getting better overall, despite maybe having some of these side effects, then you need to understand what the goal of your treatment is. But I think all of these kinds of side effects, plus numerous others that aren't on the list, are things that we're used to dealing with every day with patients and in general are quite successful in dealing with.
Before we wrap up, I'd like to let our listeners know that with regard to the key questions a patient should ask their oncologist, that you've prepared a document that is at ProstateNet. People can obtain, can download that document at prostatenet.org, prostatenet.org. In closing, Dr. Ogano, is there anything that you'd like to add to today's podcast?
I think that it's a very encouraging time because we have so many different options now for treating advanced prostate cancer. A lot of medical oncologists have not been very well trained in prostate cancer because there were no treatments, and so we never were trained in it. In this day and age, we have many, many options for patients with advanced stage prostate cancer. And so, you know, people shouldn't be discouraged if they have gotten to the so-called hormone refractory stage, because there's lots of things that we still have to offer, both before you get to chemotherapy and even afterwards.
Well, Dr. Ogano, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Tia Ogano about advanced stage prostate cancer. On behalf of everyone at the ProstateNet, thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today. Thanks as well to our listeners for taking the time to learn more about prostate health and the difference that they can make in their own life for the benefit of themselves, their friends and family, and the community to which they belong. This podcast is a copyrighted production of the ProstateNet and HearThis.com. All rights are reserved.